Well, it's time to see what is going on along the Mississippi River. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for the vacationing Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Reggie McLeod is back with us. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. We talk to him every so often to find out what's new in the driftless area of the Mississippi. And we're going to talk about eels and lampreys, water quality, a famous jazz musician, and a whole lot more. So what is happening in your part of the Mississippi? What questions do you have about creating healthy rivers? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Reggie, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Reggie. I am doing well. How are you?
Good. Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on, even though you're on vacation, aren't you?
No, I just got back.
Oh, you got back. Okay, well, I don't feel quite so bad.
No, I'm trying to dig out of all the stuff that I should have been attending to.
Oh, it's amazing what accumulates when you're on vacation. You know, before we start talking about things on the Mississippi, you know, what do you love about living near the Mississippi, Reggie?
Well, this is my favorite time of the year to be on the river. And it's just great to get out and paddle it, and it's great to bicycle. I was bicycling along the river yesterday, actually. I had a nice long bicycle trip and went by some boat landings, and I was kind of watching the action there. There's one of my favorite restaurants is right on the river here in Winona, and I just love being around it. I've lived in a boathouse for a while where I was actually living on the river, and it's great, especially in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Summer.
Yeah. A lot of places around here are great in the summer, right?
Well, that's true. I guess I just like the season. But
sure.
I was on vacation up in Hayward, and that was great. But if I go away from the river in the summer, I'm always a little restless.
Okay.
How nice a place I'm in.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that you can appreciate that, too. Now, Big River Magazine, you're celebrating 25 years this year, which is amazing. In each issue, you've been putting a few articles that ran in 1993. So this issue, you printed a story about zebra mussels, and I was really surprised that they've been invading us for so long. What's happening on that front today?
Well, and that's interesting. I'd like to get a more in-depth story on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they came here, they kind of hitched their way into the Mississippi River on barges, probably, from the Great Lakes. And for a while, they were so prevalent, there were beaches on Lake Pepin that were really covered in dead zebra mussels, shells. And they were so prevalent, and you'd pull a stick out of the water, and it was covered with zebra mussels, and docks were covered with zebra mussels. But there aren't so many of them now. I mean, they're still there, and you still see them, but those same beaches that were covered with zebra mussel shells, you might look around, and you'd find a few on there, but it's dramatically different. And part of that, I think, and this is part of the fun of being a journalist, is you get to talk to people who
right.
know a lot more than you
yeah.
do and ask them questions. And I suspect that other animals started eating zebra mussels and things just kind of worked their way back to a balance because this stretch of the river is relatively healthy. And I think they've been kind of controlled to a degree. I'm sure they cause problems, and I do see them on docks and things. But, they seem to have settled down.
Yeah,
and that's there's another article in the new magazine that's really amazing that kind of is based on a study that if you have a healthy ecosystem, a healthy environment, it's harder for invasive species to get a foothold. That's one of the best defenses against invasive species, maybe just keeping the environment healthier or keeping an ecosystem healthier.
That was a very interesting article, I thought. Why don't you talk a little bit about that in a little bit more in depth? There was a lot of statistics involved, but why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's something that biologists have been talking about for quite a while around here because they've been watching the Asian carp, and they've moved in great numbers in the lower Illinois River and the lower Mississippi River in places But the places where there's a lot of them, and these, the silver carp especially, are famous because those are the ones that jump when they hear a loud noise, when someone starts an outboard motor or something, they leap into the air. They're pretty rare up here, and even though they've found a few, they haven't found any signs that they're reproducing up in the in this part of the Mississippi River. They've even found them in the St. Croix River, and they were kind of mystified. They kind of assumed it would just be a matter of time, and in fact it may be, but they've been up here for a while now, and there still don't seem to be very many. So they've long speculated that if you have a healthy ecosystem, you don't have the opportunity for them to get established, whereas the lower Illinois River is pretty beat up. You know, environmentally, it was in pretty bad shape, and it collapsed. The ecosystem there collapsed back in the 1940s and 50s especially, and that was studied a lot because it went from being full of ducks and largemouth bass and all these kind of native wildlife to they just disappeared over the course of a couple of years. And it hasn't really recovered. So I think that provides an opening for invasive species like perhaps zebra mussels and silver carp to kind of move in then in an unhealthy system. And perhaps we're being protected. This is the first study like this that I've read the original study, and the guy who wrote the story for the magazine, Sean, did this study, and he basically found that when the river was healthier and cleaner, there were more plants growing in the water, and there were more game fish and more native fish and fewer invasive fish. And when the river was in bad shape, and his main reference is back in the late 80s, there was a drought for a couple of years, and the river got really funky. It was in pretty bad shape, and there was a lot of sewage going into the river from up in the Twin Cities, and that's all been corrected and resolved. And as it's improved, there are more game fish and more native fish and fewer invasive fish. And he mostly looked at what we call the common carp, which is invasive, but it's been here for a long time. So that's that correspondence kind of confirmed what a lot of biologists had been expecting.
Okay, now that kind of brings up the question, if we have an invasive species, does it make sense, instead of focusing on getting rid of the native or the invasive species, do we then put our efforts into making the area where they're in healthier? Does that make more sense to do that?
Well, that's what this study suggests, I guess. And I'm not a scientist, and I think that it would be a little premature to make a broad statement like that. But I think people are going to be looking at that a lot more, and they're going to be testing that and doing more studies in that direction. And that would certainly make sense, because they found if you want to restore a species, you can't just throw a bunch of them out there. You have to really restore the ecosystem that they need to live in, or they won't take, they won't.
Right. That makes sense. We're talking with Reggie McLeod. He is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Do you want to join in our conversation? How's the water quality in your area of the Mississippi? Maybe you have questions about what is a healthy river. Our number, phones are open, 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So, Reggie, what are some of the things that make a healthy river? What do you need?
Well, boy, there's a lot of things, and the complicating factor right now is climate change, because the temperature has changed and there's a lot more water in the river. And I even though I enjoy the river in the summer, for a few years now, the river has been unusually high through the summer and actually all the way into the winter a lot of times. And right now, today, at the spot of the river I'm in, the amount of water that's flowing down there is about 2.5 times the average volume of water that you'd have flowing down there today.
That's a lot.
That's a lot more. And it's not unusual anymore. People are kind of getting used to it. So what you need, some things are almost out of, I don't want to get into an argument about controlling climate change, but some things are almost out of control. If the climate's going to change like this and we're going to get more rain, what constitutes a healthy environment is going to change. So just having a few inches more of rain a year on average might change a lot of what was considered prairie country into being forest land. See, so we're kind of struggling with that. But in the river, the big change is getting sewage out of the river. The main contaminant now is nitrogen from farming.
Right.
And a lot of that runs off, and no one's made much progress in controlling that. And that, if you go out and look at the river now, it's going to look kind of brown-green. And most people think of that as muddy. Oh, the muddy Mississippi.
Right.
Well, it's muddy in the spring, but now when you see it's brown-green, that's algae. And that algae is only there because of the extra nitrogen that's gotten into the water from farming. A lot of the sewage contamination has been cleaned up, you know, decades ago. And that prevents light from penetrating into the water, and the plants can't grow, and the fish need the plants to hide in, and the ducks need the plants to eat, and that's kind of the base of a healthy river. The first pioneers that came through here and people that wrote journals about traveling through here, this time of year, they'd be out in the river, and you could see the bottom. I mean, you could see the bottom 10, 20 feet down. The water was so clear at this time of year.
Well, that's certainly not the case now, is it?
No. And it has it is improving in many ways, in fairness. But that's a good example of something that we really need to fix if we're going to have the river be healthier, you know, over the long term. The other thing, and this is important with climate change, is the locks and dams kind of prevent fish from migrating up and downstream. And if we're going to have a warmer climate, there's a lot of fish that are going to want to move north. They'll be more comfortable farther north. And anything that impedes them moving back and forth is going to make that more difficult to do. And the river is kind of silting in, too, and that's from a lot of things. Some of that is agriculture. Some of that is urban development, because we try to funnel that water instead of letting it soak into the earth as it would naturally. We try to get it in pipes and shoot it right out into the river, or in Madison, you know, they send it right to the lakes. And that not only carries a lot of pollution, but it carries a lot of sand and silt, and that tends to fill in the deep spots. And the fish need deep spots in the river, especially in the winter. They need to.
Yes, they certainly do. Well, we'll get back to that in just a little bit. We're talking with Reggie McLeod, the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. We always welcome your input, so if you want to join the discussion, call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Jill Najoe. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller, but stay with us. We'll be right back after this news update from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. You are listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today, and we're so happy to have you along on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Upper Mississippi River with Reggie McLeod. He is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Are you planning to vacation along the river? Do you have questions about what to see and where to go? Well, give us a call. I'm sure Reggie can help you out. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Reggie, we had Ann on the line since before we went to news. So let's get to her question right away, okay? Hi, Ann. You're in Green Bay?
Hello.
Yeah, what's your question?
Yep. Well, first of all, I'd like to say it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out that a healthy environment keeps away the invasives. And on that note, the Trump administration is now talking about eliminating protections for wetlands and species that are on the protected list. And I'm just wondering if you're going to be doing articles in the future that will talk to how this is going to affect the river the Mississippi River Valley, the wetlands, and the flyways?
Certainly. we always cover those things. We're trying, the purpose of Big River, it's an independent magazine, and we don't take a particular line on things. We like to present a lot of different ideas. We like to present scientific research and work that people are doing on the river, and let people judge for themselves to see what's going on. If someone asks me how to clean up the river, I might have an idea of what I think is the best way, but I think it's better journalism and it's more informative for us to look at all different perspectives on how to do that. Wetlands are extremely important, and what I was talking about, the runoff that goes into the river or the lakes, that's really damaging, and it's damaging because of the temperature of the water, raises the temperature of the lakes and so on. It carries a lot of pollutants in there. A lot of salt flows into the river and lakes in the spring when the snow and the ice thaw. And those affect the water, as do the wetlands. And one of the big problems with agriculture now in Minnesota, especially on the Minnesota River watershed, is tiling, where people put tiles, which are porous pipes that are a few feet under the surface, and those drain places that would otherwise be too wet to farm. And that means when they spread nitrogen fertilizer, when they put herbicides on the land, it goes down and into the creeks and rivers much more quickly then, and kind of waste their money too. But more importantly, that means that the rivers rise faster and fall faster, because rather than the water coming into the rivers through the groundwater in large part, it kind of flushes right into the river right after it rains. And the drain tiles help do that. Parking lots help do that too. Eaves on rooftops do that too. And that causes the riverbanks to erode a lot, because the high and low levels of the river become more extreme. They get higher and they get much lower. And the Minnesota River here in Minnesota is kind of a poster child for a really unhealthy river. And a lot of that is because of the, it rains and immediately the river is way, way high, and then a couple days lower, it's way, way low, because the water is not going into the groundwater and doing that, which would be a lot healthier for everything.
Definitely. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, we cover those things all the time. We're always trying to keep an eye on those things and changes.
And one of the things I think is nice about Big River is that you do take articles from other sources and add them into each issue, so you get a little bit of information from all over.
Yeah, the news shorts are a big part of the magazine. We do long features and short features, but we collect news from other news sources all around the upper Midwest, and we also look at scientific papers and studies that are going on and press releases from different groups and universities, and we put all that in there. That's probably the first thing that a lot of people read when they pick up the magazine, are the news shorts, because we cover a lot of ground.
Yes, you do. Let's go back to the phones. We have Ralph from Eau Claire up next. Hello, Ralph. What's your question?
Hello. I read an article recently in our local newspaper about taking out the locks and dams. I believe it was three of them, possibly, in the Twin City area. And I wondered what your guests thought about that. And when they had interesting arguments, both pro and con. But one of the big things was scouring what's now the lake bottoms once they take the dam out. What is going to happen to all of that silt that goes downstream? And I'll take your answer off the phone.
Okay, thanks, Ralph. Silt is a big problem, isn't it?
Oh, and that's a fascinating story. And we had, last week, there were a number of meetings up in the Twin Cities on that. And we had two people up there actually covering them for us. And these locks and dams on the river were only built to enable shipping on the river. They're there to maintain a 9-foot channel in the river so you can push barges that are 9 feet deep everywhere in the river. They don't do any flood control. A few of them generate some electricity. And in the Twin Cities, most of them were built in the 30s, but in the Twin Cities, one was built early in the 20th century by a Ford plant, by Henry Ford, to generate electricity for that plant. And it also had a lock in it so that boats could lock through and go upstream in the Twin Cities. And then in the 60s, they built two more locks and dams on St. Anthony Falls, which is right at downtown Minneapolis, because Minneapolis wanted to have a port. St. Paul had one and Minneapolis didn't, and there's always this little rivalry between the cities up there, of course. And that port was closed a couple years ago. The city owned the land, and the city decided not to renew the lease and to use the land for parks and other development, and they closed the port. So right after that, they closed the lock on Upper St. Anthony Falls, supposedly to keep carp from migrating through it, getting up to northern Minnesota. And there's really no reason to maintain those locks anymore because there's no more commercial traffic. And the one at the Ford Dam, which is Lock and Dam 1, it was built by Henry Ford, that has about a 40-some-foot drop in the lock. I mean, it's really kind of creepy to lock through there because you actually, the elevation of the water drops about 40 feet, maybe a little less. And what that means is that that dam is accumulated silt behind it that might be in places, you know, over 30 feet deep. And this was accumulated since early in the 20th century. So there's, it probably has a lot of heavy metals and all kinds of toxins in it.
Sure.
So the concern of a lot of people living downstream is if you take that dam out, there'll be a lot of silt, of course, that'll go down and fill in parts of the river. It would be hard to keep it open to navigation and so on. But also, it would put a lot of toxins into the river. So, excuse me, they're trying to get the Army Corps of Engineers to commit to dredging out all that material that's accumulated behind the dam. And that may go up for several miles, too, so it'd be a huge project to do and clean that out before they would consider taking the dam down. And by the way, the Coast Guard this spring said that they're not even going to maintain channel markers above that Ford Dam anymore because of the silt that's accumulated. It was hard to keep it open, and there's really no point to keeping a 9-foot channel up there anymore. So they said, you know, we're not even going to support navigation and channel markers up there anymore. So it's an interesting situation. The Army Corps would save a lot of maintenance and money if they closed all those locks and they could use it elsewhere. A lot of environmentalists want to get the dams out because rivers are healthier without dams. And that stretch of river actually would be a rocky rapids up above there if the Ford Dam wasn't there. That's why riverboats couldn't get up there before the dam was built. They could if the water was really high and you had a real daring pilot.
Right.
But they wouldn't normally go up there because of all the rocks and the shallow water. Mm-hmm. So if they restore that, it'll be exciting kayaking, and it'll be natural. The fish can migrate and so on.
Yeah, I could see that being a big draw. I'm sure you'll keep us abreast as to what's going on with that particular topic over the months.
Yeah, it'll be going on for years, actually. So it'll be a lot of fodder for stories. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Ralph. That was a great question. And one thing I want to talk to you about, Reggie, is I had never heard about this Mississippi River floodplain model that was built by the POWs from World War II. Tell us a little bit about that. Had you heard about that?
No, I never heard about it either. That's why we're lucky to have some of the writers that we have, because they kind of charge around and try to find things like that. And Connie Cherba, who lives in Dubuque, found that. And she and her husband tour the river a lot and kind of look for things like that. And she's a history buff. And they actually you know, now that we have computers, we can model hydrology on computers, and it's still very complicated to do that.
Yes.
And that's a pretty recent thing. It wasn't that long ago. They were just guessing, and so they built this huge model down south and near Jackson, Mississippi, to model the behavior of the river so they'd know how high to make the levees and how to control the water a little better and how to avoid flooding. And they built it in the 40s, and they actually had POWs working on this. And it's a huge model, and it's overgrown now with woods and brush, and there's a group that's trying to restore it so you can see it. They actually used a creek to supply water to this. And
it's the size of 2 football fields, is that right?
Well, I think it's actually even
is it bigger than that?
Yeah,
and yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, it's huge, and it had a sump tower that holds 500,000 gallons of water that they could kind of talk about flushing water through something.
Mm-hmm. And it was a tourist attraction back in the 40s and 50s, right? Or 50s?
Yeah. There's a postcard in the story, actually.
Yeah.
Back then, people are looking at it, and they had the cities modeled and the levees modeled and everything. And they'd really have to set up an experiment and get all their sensors and get everything the way they wanted it, and then kind of turn on the water and then go around and measure things and see how it worked.
Yeah, it's really ingenious if you think about it.
Yeah, it's about 200 acres.
Here. Oh, 200 acres. Okay. I knew it was big.
Yeah, and it's lower 1,000 miles of the river about that they modeled with us, and the tributaries. So
mm-hmm.
They had parts of the Missouri River and the Ohio River and so on, too, in that. Yeah, no, I'd never heard of it before. I have a lot of fun working on these stories, too.
I'll bet you do. We're talking with Reggie McLeod. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Do you have questions about, water quality in the Mississippi or some places to visit or anything Mississippi? Well, we'd like to hear from you. The phone lines are open, 1-800-642-1234. And you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Reggie, one of the articles that I really enjoyed in this issue was the one on eels and lampreys. I mean, eels and lampreys, but they're so fascinating. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, you don't see them very often on the river. And I know first time I became aware of them around here was I was trout fishing one day, and I was on this pool, a nice pool on a trout stream, and I thought I saw a snake swimming underwater, and I looked a little closer, and suddenly I saw the whole bottom was covered with these snakes swimming underwater.
Oh, my.
They were actually eels. I think they were chestnut eels.
Okay.
They must have been spawning or something, but there were probably a couple hundred of them just in this one pool. So there are native ones that stay around here, but the American eel that is in the story, that one actually migrates up the river, and in order to spawn, they go all the way down the river into the Gulf of Mexico, into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and probably spawn there. But they haven't been able to study them enough to really find out much about that, because the water is so deep there and it's such a huge area that they're kind of guessing about what goes on out there. But then the young eels, which are kind of in a larval stage, eventually find their way back to the Mississippi River or whatever river they came from and work their way up here again. And when they're migrating up the river, the dams aren't so much of a problem for them, because if it's a damp night, if there was dew or rain, they crawl up on the ground and crawl through the weeds and grass and then go around the dam and go back in the river at night. So if you're walking around,
I can't imagine seeing that.
A dam at night, you might stumble on some big eels slithering around the grass. Yeah.
People would be surprised. They would be very surprised.
Yeah, and then lamprey eels too. They're not even eels. They're a fish that looks like an eel. And I grew up around the Great Lakes. when I was younger, and that was a big deal when the lampreys got in there, because they're parasites on fish, mm-hmm. and they helped destroy the population of lake trout. Of course, the water quality helped with that too.
Yep. But, going back to that.
Yeah. So this is a fun article. Covers all of those eels.
Yeah, I had no idea about them. And they are, like I said, they're very, very interesting. I really suggest people do a little investigation, because you'll be surprised about what they can do. You know, we, a while back, there was a problem at the Tempelo River tributary when there was that accident in the frac sand mine. Can you update us a little bit about what happened?
Yes, there was a slurry pond on a creek, a tributary of the Tremolo River, that a guy was working on it in a bulldozer, and the bulldozer was on kind of a steep bank, and it rolled upside down into the pond. And this slurry pond is where, when they process the sand, they take sandstone and break it into sand to sell for frac drilling. Anyway, he was upside down in the slurry pond in a water-tight cab, so he had enough air to survive for a while. So to rescue him, they breached the dike around the pond, and all of that slurry, well, a lot of the slurry, flowed into the creek that was nearby, and that flowed into the Tremolo River, which flows into the Mississippi River at Tremolo. And at first they said it wasn't, no danger to the public, which is what they always say.
Unfortunately.
Yes, they looked at the water samples more closely, and there were heavy metals and other contaminants in there. And they were far above the safety level when they flowed into the creek. But as the creek flowed into the river, and the Tremolo River, and more creeks flowed into it, that became diluted to a point that wasn't over the standards by the time it got into the Mississippi River. So it goes back to that old creepy saying that people used to say, the solution to pollution is dilution. not really a solution, but
no,
it looked that way at times.
It isn't.
So I don't know if they're going to levy charges for contaminating that creek, because mm-hmm. the creek for sure probably was damaged.
Yeah, I would think something is in the works on that. We do have a phone call from Mike that I'd like to take. He's in Waupun. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a quick question. I kind of tuned in late, but I was wondering if your guest has any information on my wife and I and a 15-year-old son would like to do something on the upper Mississippi River between, like, say, La Crosse and Dubuque areas. We could go a little farther north or a little farther south, but maybe charter fishing or something like that, if he has any tips or ideas on how to locate something like that.
Well, there are several places that rent houseboats, and I think La Crosse might have some. I'm not sure. I know Lansing, Iowa, and McGregor, Iowa, do have houseboat rentals, and that can be fun. There are excursion boats in Winona and McGregor and La Crosse, and some of those are, they have eco-tours. They go out into the backwaters, and they point out, you know, you'll find eagles and different wildlife, and they'll answer questions and that sort of thing. Those are two of the best. One problem is the river is kind of high. I think that hopefully in the next couple of weeks it's going to get low enough where it's going to be safer. I'd be a little reluctant to take my family out in a houseboat right now. But like I said, keep an eye on it. It's definitely getting better. Those are probably the best. You can charter sailboats up on Lake Pepin even, and there are probably some houseboat rentals up that way too that can get you out on the river.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Well, and Mike, have fun. That sounds like a really fun thing to do with your family. Do you have a lot on the Mississippi that are visitors like that?
Yeah, and, you know, one of the cool things, and I should have mentioned it with Mike, is you can camp the stretch between Nelson, Wisconsin, and the Quad Cities in Iowa and Illinois is Upper Mississippi Fish and Wildlife Refuge, and you can camp on the beaches. You can camp almost anywhere on there without registering or paying a fee. So if you can get out on the river, it's really nice. And during the weekends, those can get a little crowded, but during the week, you have a lot of good choices for where you want to hang out or camp out or just tie up the boat and live on the boat.
There you go. That sounds like a great option. And real quick, before we have to leave, Ross and Madison had emailed and was wondering about that increased water flow. He wants to canoe. Wouldn't it be a good time for that?
I'd wait a little bit.
A little bit? Like sure. A month or two?
Well, you just have to keep an eye on it.
Okay.
You can look at weather sites. And so we'll go to Big River. Can I mention our website?
Absolutely.
BigRiverMagazine.com. And we have some connections to sites where you can check water levels and so on.
All right.
If you want to call us and talk, can I give the number real quick?
Yep, real quick.
1-800-303-8601.
Okay, well, great. Thank you again so much, Reggie. We always appreciate you coming in. We've been talking to Reggie McLeod. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Thanks to Kate Archer-Kent for on-air production and to Dave Potras for technical direction. Tomorrow at this time, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back to help you with your pet care questions. That starts at 11 on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Stay with us. There's always more to come.